We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
I don't think God's through with me. I really believe he thinks there's still some good things I can do.
We would like to tell the president to reconsider his position. 90% of the African-American vote went for him because he was American dream. He was a result of the civil rights movement. And just like he listened to the homosexuals, give us an ear.
Nicification happens when leaders and laity start assuming that our primary role is to be very nice, even at the expense of objective truth.
We have this crazy idea in the Missouri Synod that when pastors get a call, all of a sudden the Holy Ghost is going to talk to them over the next couple weeks about what they're supposed to do or what God's telling them.
Thank you for providing theology for clerical collar, white collar, and blue collar.
Those of us who trace our theological roots and ancestry to the 16th century, to the Lutheran Reformation, to Germany, to a particular little state of Germany, often think about that as an epicenter of the Christian faith. Perhaps at one time it was, and yet at an earlier time, it most certainly wasn't. There was a time when people who lived in that area that later would become Germany were not Christians. They were far from Christians. And then Christian missionaries came. The church remembers one today, Boniface of Mainz in the 8th century. We're going to be talking about him, remembering him along with the church in the first few minutes of Issues Etc. live this Tuesday afternoon. It's the 5th of June. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. Now, you can join us. We'll be talking about Boniface of Mainz for a few minutes. Deaconess Pam Nielsen will join us after that from Witness Mercy Life Together to teach a Sunday school lesson. We'll talk about Jacob's death and burial in Genesis chapter 49, near the very end of that book. Dr. Jennifer Roback Morris will be our guest in the second hour of the program for a few minutes to talk about several issues, the current state of affairs with California's same-sex marriage ban, Prop 8. It was a ruling by the New Mexico Court of Appeals that a Christian photographer's refusal to take pictures of a gay couple's commitment ceremony violated the state's discrimination laws. I think there was a fine imposed. We'll see what Jennifer thinks about that as well. And then for the remainder of Hour 2 of Issues, Etc., Pastor Bill Swirla will be our guest. We're going to talk about religious pluralism. You can join us as well, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. Our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesetc.org, and our Twitter address, @issuesetc. Dr. Matt Phillips is Associate Professor of History at Concordia University, Nebraska. Matt, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Good to be back.
You're going to have to orient us in history with regard to Boniface of Mainz being remembered by the church today. For those of us who aren't experts in European and medieval history, what markers in history would you place him next to so we can kind of find him on the timeline, so to speak?
Okay, so Boniface was mainly active in the early 8th century, so the early 700s. Boniface really came before, most people have heard of Charlemagne. Most people heard about Charlemagne in world history or Western Civ or something. He came maybe two generations before Charlemagne. For instance, Boniface was a church reformer and worked with Charlemagne's grandfather, Charles Martel, who was a Frankish ruler, and Charlemagne's father, Pippin the Short, who became king of the Franks later. So that's probably the best marker, I would say, that most people will be most familiar with.
He's known as a missionary to the Germans. Of course, this is long before Germany existed as a state. But what was the native endemic religion of the so-called German people at the time?
Well, of the Germanic peoples of the time who were not Christian, most of them were some type of some type of what we would think of as Scandinavian-style paganism or Germanic paganism. They had various gods, often associated with the woodlands and the woods. Some of our days of the week are named for these gods, like Thor's Day, Thursday, Woden's Day, Wednesday. So some of the Viking gods we've heard of. The Germanic religion had similar multiple polytheistic worship of various gods, usually associated with things in nature. So that would be the basic type of religious practice and beliefs there were.
So tell us the story of Boniface of Mainz.
Well, Boniface was not originally called Boniface. His name was actually Winfrith or Winfred. He was actually an Anglo-Saxon, which meant he was from what today would be England, the southwestern part of modern England, which at the time was known as Wessex, or the West Saxon Kingdom. They still use these terms, actually, Wessex, Kent, Essex. So he was from Wessex, which would be southwestern England, kind of down by the coastal area of southwestern England. And that area was Christianized by that time. There had been a missionary from Rome in the early 600s that had come, and most of the people there had embraced Christianity, at least outwardly. Winfrith, who became Boniface, joined a monastery of some type around 700. He was born around 680, and he eventually becomes a priest and also a teacher in a school that was probably connected to a monastery or teaching people to become priests or pastors. And he becomes a priest probably at the age of 30, and not too long after that, he decides to go on a trip to the continent from England in order to be a missionary, as it were, to these many of the Germanic peoples who were also related to the Anglo-Saxons, of course. Their language was still similar at that time. And there were already some missionary activity from people who came before Boniface that he knew. And he first went to a pagan group called the Frisians, who were essentially in the area of what we would think of today as the Netherlands. Well, there was another fellow already preaching there named Willibrord. And Boniface, the guy who becomes Boniface, eventually goes to Rome twice. Actually made three trips to Rome, but the first two trips were in the 716 and the next one in early 720s. And the Pope at the time, Pope Gregory the II, gave him the name Boniface, and that's why he's known. It was a Latinized name, which was not an uncommon practice for the church to do at the time. And that's the name he's given, and that's what he's known by. And he becomes commissioned, essentially, by the Bishop of Rome to become a missionary to the German-speaking peoples of what today would essentially be Central Germany. And to be he's often known as the quote apostle to the Germans, or we would think of it today as a missionary, pastor missionary to the Germans.
This really lays the foundation, obviously, some 8 or 9 centuries prior, but it lays the foundation for what would later become the conditions for the Reformation there. Just the fact that he establishes a bishopric in Germany that would later have. Have some political influence there, too.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously there's a lot of historical development. But yes, ultimately, the bishopric, which he establishes and he is given authority over, the Archbishopric of Mainz becomes what is usually called the Primatial See, or kind of what the Archbishop of Canterbury becomes in the Church of England, is what the Archbishop of Mainz was in the German-speaking lands, and what later will be called the Holy Roman Empire. It had nothing like that. It was not called that at that time. And the Archbishop of Mainz, until really, I think the early 1800s, had quite a bit of political power, too. But that's much later. But yes, this era did lay the foundation for that. He was actually papal legate and, as I said, given the authority to essentially be, he was given the authority carte blanche to be the bishop to the Germans, essentially. And then it was later that Mainz was made into the archbishopric before he died.
So what would this have been like? I mean, this is obviously before any kind of religious establishment to speak of, Christian religious establishment.
In a lot of these places, yes.
So what would being a bishop and a missionary to the Germanic people have been
well,
like?
Well, one, it could be very dangerous. Not to ruin the end of the story, one of the reasons he becomes such a significant saint in the Middle Ages, and that he is buried at Fulda Monastery And that's full of cathedral today, and you can still go there. Roman Catholics, for instance, could still go there and venerate him as a saint if they so chose. His relics are still there, and as far as we know, they're genuine. So that's where he's buried. One of the reasons he becomes such a significant saint is because he was martyred. He was actually killed by back up there preaching to the Frisians in his later age in the 750s. He is actually killed by this group known as the Frisians. The circumstances are a bit unclear, but we know that's how he died. And then his body was ultimately brought back to Fulda Monastery in central Germany, pretty close to Mainz. And that's where he was buried. And now, as I said, that church is now the cathedral in Fulda. So, as I said, the shrine is still there.
He is considered the patron saint of Germany. Why is that part of the story there?
Yeah, I think that becomes important in the Middle Ages because of his significance as a missionary to the Germans. And in Catholic Germany today, even, he's still very venerated in that sense.
We got about a minute here, Matt. Before we take our break, if we were to pick up Boniface and we were to plunk him down in modern-day Germany, where things are increasingly secular, almost to the point of being entirely secular, what do you think he would have to say about that?
From a moral point of view, he would probably become a ardent law preacher. I mean, he was a medieval monk and a Christian. But he would probably preach the law the same way he preached the law to the pagans. And then with that, the gospel, that their sins could be forgiven for Christ's sake. It's a very good chance he could end up going somewhere and becoming a martyr again. That seemed to be the kind of attitude that he had, that he was willing to go to follow Christ and bring the message of the gospel to wherever he needed to go.
When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Matt Phillips, Associate Professor of History at Concordia University, Nebraska, and talk about this era that is marked by missionary martyrs, men who did not consider it, they did not consider their lives worth sparing if it would mean bringing the gospel to people who had never heard it. Dr. Matt Phillips is our guest. This is Issues Etc. Stay tuned. Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Emmanuel Lutheran, Alexandria, Virginia. Bethel Lutheran, Ballinger, Texas, Mount Calvary Lutheran, Eola, Texas, Beautiful Savior Lutheran, Bridgeton, Missouri, Christ Our King Community Lutheran, Costa Mesa, California, Lord of Life Lutheran, Plano, Texas, Christ Lutheran, Platte Woods, Missouri, Hope Lutheran, Sonora, Texas, Faith Lutheran, Azona, Texas, and Emmanuel Lutheran, Steger, Illinois. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, and click support. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll advertise your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues Etc. 300.
Historic. Authentic. Christian Radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
If Issues Etc. refuses to scratch your itchy ears and scratches your old scabs instead, and you love them for it, then Redeemer Lutheran Church is the church in Fort Wayne for you. The only real difference between Issues Etc. and Redeemer is that Todd and Jeff only talk about Jesus. We talk about Jesus, but we also put him into people's mouths. We drive off demons with water. We are the church. And yes, we serve Jell-O in the basement.
The Head That Once Was Crowned with Thorns, sung by the St. Olaf Kantorei, playing right now at Lutheran Public Radio, lutheranpublicradio.org. It's 24/7 internet music station, music of the church, sacred music for the world, anytime, absolutely free, lutheranpublicradio.org. That and countless other selections from all the centuries of church music there at lutheranpublicradio.org. Dr. Matt Phillips is our guest, Associate Professor of History at Concordia University, Nebraska. You mentioned he was a reformer, and this kind of puts him in contact, as you say, with the generations that preceded Charlemagne. What did it mean to be a reformer?
That's a good question. A lot of that had to do with moral reform among the clergy. In every age has its clergy who are willing to abuse their positions. And a lot of clergy lived not appropriate lives. And a lot of that had to do with the moral life of the clergy. Other types of reform would have been outward, setting up the outward ecclesiastical structure of the church. Again, we're talking about some areas that hadn't had no outward ecclesiastical structure. I mean, they had not been part of the Roman Empire, right? So now you had him setting up dioceses. He's really responsible, with the help of some of those Frankish rulers, for setting up a lot of the most significant dioceses of central Germany, all the way to Salzburg, which would be modern-day Austria. But so that's part of reform, too. And then also doctrinal reform. I mean, he combated pagans, and he spoke against their religious beliefs and tried to convince them of his. So the main thing they usually tried to do was convert Germanic warlords, because in Germanic practice, if the warlord or ruler converted, everybody else kind of went along with him. So that was usually the practice that was done. And then they would catechize people after that, and then baptize people en masse, so, and then catechize people that way.
So we're talking there in terms of the Frankish reforms that he was involved in. Really, a general category would be ecclesiastical supervision. He sets up a system.
Yes,
of ecclesiastical supervision.
He was given that authority too, or however you want to look at it, from the papacy's point of view, for the 8th century papacy anyway, he was given that or granted that authority. I mean, the papacy in the 8th century was pretty weak, practically speaking, but everybody still kind of looked to it as the patriarch of the West. So it's not like the papacy, say, of the 13th century, which actually has real ecclesiastical oversight, or even today, you know, in the Roman Catholic Church. But he was given a lot of authority to do set up things the way he saw fit. But he always had to count on, he needed muscle. And when I say muscle, I mean the Frankish warlords, which often even the so-called Christian Frankish warlords were not nice guys. They had their own ulterior motives sometimes, too, about using the church to promote their own power. So those were all the issues that he was dealing with.
So these warlords, I mean, I'm picturing some guy sitting around eating a leg of mutton around a bonfire. What are we talking about?
Yeah, I think that's a good picture. You know, they lived in, for the most part, wooden fortifications, maybe some stone, depending on where the city was. A lot of these guys didn't exactly have great theological or virtuous lives, or didn't really understand as much as they should have. And that was another part of the reform, trying to reform the rulers themselves. But they did want to spread their authority and control things. And so there was always kind of this tenuous relationship with them that really goes back to the fall of the Roman Empire. How does the church deal with leaders who are Christian, but, you know, as sinners are going to sin? So,
were these conversions that he was able to effect, so to speak, among these warlords? You get two generations down the line, and you've got Charlemagne, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah, but, you know, yes, in one sense, on Charlemagne's side, a lot of his background, they had been Christian for quite a long time, at least to the further west you go, further towards what would be modern-day France. But, yes, Charlemagne kind of brings it all together in the sense that in what today would be maybe northern France and western Germany, and extends that whole, essentially what becomes an empire, with the help of the church, and vice versa. They had a, I would say, symbiotic relationship in a way. You know, the Charlemagne and his predecessors and his successors provided civil authority and protection of the church, and the church kind of gave them order and a sense of, you know, promoting God's will in the world.
So can you track, as you look at this, you know, kind of from Boniface on through the missionary work, having a secondary result in that kind of the civilizing of Central Europe?
Certainly Christians could see it that way. It's civilizing from a Christian perspective of bringing everybody certainly wouldn't practice it all the time, but bringing the standards of biblical or Christian morality, certainly. You would have had polygamy pretty much would have gone away eventually, although a lot of kings and rulers kept concubines, at least legally, they would have had one wife. So, yes, in some ways, that would have changed outwardly for sure. The worship of pagan gods, people we might call Thor, today, not related to the comic book or movie in any way, but certainly went away. Churches were built. Monasticism grew. Monasticism as an institution that was linked to the church was very significant. I mean, Boniface was a monk, essentially, originally. All those things certainly grew up and changed society to a great extent.
There's a story for which Boniface is known, a encounter with paganism, wherein I guess he chopped down a tree. Tell us a story.
Yeah, this is kind of a fun story about Boniface. It's too good not to believe. It's one of those kind of stories. But there was a tree called the Donner Oak, which Donner in German means thunder, and that's actually similar to Thor. So it's an oak tree that was dedicated to one of the gods, probably associated with Thor. And he begins his ministry among these pagans in what today would be northern Hesse state in Germany, central Germany. And he goes, and it's kind of like Elijah and the prophets. It's a very similar story. So you kind of think maybe they borrowed a piece of that. He goes and he challenges the priest of Thor, of the pagan priest, to a competition. He starts hacking down this tree, and you know it's this massive oak tree, and he just hits it one time, and it just falls over. And then he says, "Let Thor strike me down with lightning." And of course, he's not struck down with lightning. And all the pagan priests convert, and all the people see that Christianity, Christ, is the real God. And then the story is even better. He takes the wood from this oak tree, and they build the church out of it. It has so many good parts to it. It's a great story.
How much of it do you think is true? But even if not, what does it say about how Boniface was regarded as a missionary?
It says he had a lot of intestinal fortitude that kind of attitude may have, even in his older years, led to him being killed by the Frisian pagans. The story is really interesting in a lot of ways. I would guess that it took more than one hack, but you know that's one of the miracle parts of it. But also, it demonstrates that the Christian God is really the God over nature. And in control of everything, it's against idolatry. But notice how they take the wood from the tree and build a church. And this was a common tactic of missionary work, was going back to even before Boniface, that was promoted by Gregory the Great. You make the pagan sacred sites into where the churches should be built, so the people are used to going to the same place.
What would Boniface make of kind of the accommodation that marks so much of, whether cultural, now we've even heard recently about kind of religious accommodation on the part of missionary efforts today, where you go in, we talked about this recently on the program, a Christian missionary goes into a Muslim culture, and he basically adopts the Muslim religious rites in order to somehow reach Muslims. What would Boniface make of that?
That's a good question. I'm not sure exactly how I think about that. I will say this, the general attitude among, going back to Gregory the Great, which was a century before and forward, was you can adopt whatever needs to be adopted as long as it doesn't change, as long as they know the doctrine's different and the teaching's different. For, like I said, you can build the church in the same holy place, but they need to know it's a church, and while you're there worshiping. And then you catechize them, you teach them. We're talking about teaching people who were, for the most part, had no written language. You know, that's another thing. There would have been no written Germanic language outside of it being written down by the church coming in and creating a written language. There's a fine line there always. You know, at what point does accommodation become watering down the gospel? You know, maybe you should... And then on the other hand, you know, you had this whole contest between Frankish Christian warlords and pagan warlords, and that played a role in there too. So the Frankish Christian warlords wanted to use your Christianity to as a weapon against the against the pagan warlords. You know, if we can convert them and then control them, it's easier.
Dr. Matt Phillips is Associate Professor of History at Concordia University, Nebraska. Matt, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for being our guest.
Thanks for having me.